You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
We're talking Cardinals baseball today on the second day of February. It is Matt Wehmeyer with Jen Langosch, our Cardinals reporter. Jen, thank you for the time as always. And Jen, the baseball gods blessing us with some great news the day before we do our podcast. So that was welcome. As on Wednesday night, Carlos Martinez and the team come to terms on a five-year, $51 million deal. This buys out arbitration years and a couple of free agent years, and it just seems like the ultimate win-win for both sides, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, for Carlos Martinez, he was looking for the financial security that this deal provides. I mean, this is a guy who grew up in the Dominican Republic and grew up in such poverty that as a child, he didn't own a pair of shoes. So when you think about the impact of a $51 million contract can have, not just on his life, but on generations for his family and within the community, which he's still integrally involved in and does a lot of charity work with, it was something that he really wanted. And from the Cardinals' perspective, I mean, what they see in Carlos is an ace. I mean, this is a guy that they believe could make a run at Cy Young Awards in the future that's going to anchor this rotation for a long time. And they're getting him right now at age 25. In his prime. This deal will take him through the age 30 season, and if the Cardinals exercise both of the club options, it would take him through 2023. So as the Cardinals try to lock down some centerpieces, some core players looking forward to the future, Carlos Martinez was at the top of the list. This was something that the team and Carlos's representatives have been working on throughout the offseason, and really something that they had hoped to get wrapped up before an arbitration hearing next week, which, of course, with the announcement today, they were able to do.
Yeah, it's great news for both the team and for the player, Carlos Martinez. And Jen, you touched on this a little bit, but just to expand, you know, does a contract like this, given Carlos's age and the stage he's at of his career, does it kind of send an unspoken message that, you know what, you've been very good for us, and we know that you are going to be very good, but we need you to be more. We need you to be that undisputed ace, and we need you to be the guy that will one day, and maybe one day soon, take over that mantle from Adam Wainwright as the face of this rotation and the guy that you can count on every fifth day.
Yeah, I think so. You know, when we talk about ace, it doesn't always simply come down to who's the best pitcher. Because I think if we ask, you know, who's the Cardinals' best pitcher heading into 2017, 10 out of 10 people would say Carlos Martinez. But that being said, you know, along with that term ace comes a responsibility. It comes leadership and all those things that Adam Wainwright has meant. And, you know, before Adam, it was Chris Carpenter and what they have done to really lead a rotation, not just on the field with their performance, but also off the field. And I was encouraged that one of the things Carlos Martinez emphasized at his press conference earlier today was that he's ready to step up in that regard. And, you know, we've seen Carlos really grow up here in front of our eyes at the major league level because he broke through so young at the age of 21. And he has matured in great ways. He's matured with the way that he utilizes his pitches, but he's also matured in his behavior off the field. So as you look at a Cardinals club that now has a young pitcher in Alex Reyes coming up, I think Carlos Martinez has a great opportunity here to start being a mentor to a guy like Alex Reyes in the same way that Adam Wainwright was to him. But yeah, I mean, we're nearing the point with this organization where Adam Wainwright and Yadier Molina are no longer going to be the faces for this club, that it's going to transition into a new wave of younger players. And at the center of that, I think, is Carlos Martinez, again, both from what we've seen in terms of his maturity off the field and then obviously the electric stuff that he brings on the field.
And, Jen, maybe this is looking a bit too far ahead and getting a bit too speculative on my part, but just for fun, let's try it on for size anyway. You know, considering how open Carlos Martinez has been in saying, you know, again, very openly, I want to be in St. Louis for the rest of my career. He made no bones about that. When you look at that and you look at all the charity work that he's done, this is something that we talked about, especially over the holidays, things that he's done in both his homeland and in St. Louis. He's been such a role model in so many regards, you know, in terms of helping the less privileged and the unfortunate. You know, is there potential down the road, I'm talking, I don't know, 10, 15 years here, for a guy like him, given all these things in his ledger right now, to be as revered and as beloved as somebody like perhaps an Albert Pujols during his prime years in St. Louis? I mean, are we talking about a guy who, again, has this potential to one day have that kind of stature within the community and within, you know, the franchise itself?
Yeah, I mean, I think the potential is there, and credit goes to Carlos, too, for really being able to integrate himself in this community, being a non-native English speaker. I mean, this is a guy who he can speak English, you know, sparingly, still uses a translator for the most part just because he's more confident that way. But for him to become so beloved in this community so quickly at a young age, and again, with a background that's so different than most people that live here, I think really speaks to the effort that he has made. I think one of the things that has really endeared him to the fan base, too, is just his love of the game. I mean, when you watch Carlos Martinez pitch, you see a joy that perhaps you don't see when you see others on the mound. It's one of the reasons why, you know, I'll tell anybody, my favorite days going to the ballpark are when Carlos Martinez is pitching. There is just a childlike innocence to the way that he handles himself on the field. And the days that he's not pitching, we see him in the dugout dancing, building cup towers, splashing water in the faces of teammates after they hit home runs. He just loves life. He loves the game. Again, I think his background has a lot to do with that. He realizes where he came from and the gifts that he's been given to now be able to create a great living for he and his family, but also for others in his former community. And that is always going to endear him to the fan base here. I mean, what will be interesting moving forward is Carlos Martinez still has the potential to hit free agency at a very prime age, whether that's age 30 or if the option years are exercised age 32. You know, Adam Wainwright is unique, and then I think he's going to be a lifetime Cardinal. Yadier Molina, I think, is going to be a lifetime Cardinal. Will Carlos Martinez follow suit and end up as a lifetime Cardinal? It's really hard to say with the way baseball economics are and the money that might be thrown his way in 5 to 7 years, but there's certainly the potential there, I think, for him to solidify himself as one of the greatest Cardinals of this generation if he can reach the talent that we all see in him.
Yeah, I mean, you can never fault a guy for chasing money despite what you read on Twitter or YouTube nowadays. You know, a guy has one shot at a huge payday to secure himself and his family, you know, literally for the rest of their lives. And he's a guy who, like you said, he has been very forthcoming in saying, I want to stay here. I don't want to go anywhere. So hopefully, when that day comes, you know, the expectations of the team and of himself and his goals of wanting to stay there will all come together. The money will be there. And this is a guy that, like you said, I think everybody is rooting for to be successful and to be in a Cardinals uniform until that very final day, which is hopefully a long ways off. So, Jen, to transition from something very good and very uplifting to something not so good and not so uplifting at all, of course, the saga involving the fallout from the Chris Correa situation, as Commissioner Rob Manfred stripping the Cardinals of the two draft picks plus $2 million. They go the way of the Houston Astros for the breach of security, which occurred a couple of years ago in the Astros database. When you look at that punishment, are we talking, you know, is it just, is it fair, unfair? Where do you fall on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more than fair. And really, I think a lot of people were anticipating that could have been harsher. So, you know, in some ways, perhaps the Cardinals got off as well as they could have expected. I think the only good and uplifting thing in this story for the Cardinals is that it's finally over. I mean, this has been hanging over the organization now for 2 years. It was February of 2015 when the organization first learned it was being investigated by the FBI and the Justice Department. You know, from there, we've seen a criminal case, and we've seen the Cardinals fire Chris Correa, their former scouting director, for his involvement. We've seen Correa go to jail, where he's now serving a 46-month sentence. And we've seen baseball since, you know, open its own investigation. I think the Cardinals were very relieved in that MLB's investigation came to the same conclusions that those before them had, which was that Correa acted alone in this and there was nobody else in the organization that was responsible. But the reality is, I mean, the money the Cardinals paying a $2 million fine to the Astros, again, in baseball economic terms, that's pretty easy to move past. But the draft pick losses, those are going to hurt. And it's not just that the Cardinals won't be picking 56th and 75th anymore. It's that they also lose the draft bonus money that was attached to those picks. So instead of having about a $4 million bonus pool, the Cardinals are going to go into the 2017 draft with only about a bonus pool of around $2 million, so by far the lowest in the majors. So that's really going to hamper their ability to maybe pick some players later that they could maybe in the past have lured away from college commitments because they won't have the funds to do so. And for a team that has really been defined by how well it's drafted and developed talent, there could be a little bit of void this year for the organization as they go into a draft without as many picks.
Yeah, this was certainly more than a slap on the wrist, but like you alluded to in hearing the comments from John Mozeliak and other, you know, members of the front office and the team, I think the overwhelming feeling right now is relief, even though the punishment was stiff. They're just happy that it's over. They can put it behind them. They can move forward and not have to hear or read the name Chris Correa again for quite some time. I think that is something that everybody is going to embrace. That is a good way to wrap this one up. Jen Langosch, our Cardinals reporter, will do it again at this time next week. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, St. Louis Cardinals. It is Thursday, February 2nd, and we're talking Pirates baseball today with Adam Berry, our Pirates reporter. And Adam, let's dive right in. Tuesday's news, or perhaps it was Wednesday, was one of the 2 days. You see where my brain's at to start things off. But the news that Josh Bell is going to undergo surgery on his left knee. There were some loose bodies, as the saying goes, in that knee. He had felt some discomfort for some time. So, Adam, how long is he going to be out? And how concerned, if concerned at all, are the Pirates about this setback for Bell?
Yeah, Josh Bell had surgery on Wednesday to remove that loose body from his left knee. The Pirates have said the typical recovery time for that procedure is 2 to 4 weeks. But they also said his status for opening day is still to be determined, which is kind of interesting because if you do the math with me there, in 2 weeks, you know, he would basically be starting spring training on time or maybe a couple days behind. Even 4 weeks, you know, he would be back to baseball activities at the beginning of March, which would give him a full month to sort of ramp his way up for opening day in Boston. And even then, he probably would only have to be capable of DHing to even make the opening day roster. So I don't think it's a huge concern as far as, you know, the timing of it. It's actually probably a good thing. You know, it would be a lot worse if this happened in the middle of spring training or something like that. The Pirates don't seem that concerned. They've had guys make their way back from similar surgeries in a month or less. Chris Stewart did it in 2014, and he's a catcher, so that's even more demanding on the knee. The only potential cause for concern, I guess you could say, is that Bell sat out most of the 2012 season, which was actually his first in Pro Bowl, after having surgery to repair a torn meniscus in that same knee, and then he missed time in 2014 with a bone bruise in that same knee. So you hope this is not related in any sort of way, just sort of a minor thing that cropped up during off-season workouts. But the Pirates feel good about where Bell's at in general. He's in tremendous shape, as we talked about on the podcast before. He was at minicamp a couple of weeks ago. He's worked really hard at first base several times this off-season with members of the Pirates coaching staff. So it obviously something to monitor as spring training begins here in a couple of weeks, but it's not necessarily a big setback in any way.
And that's certainly a relief for the Pirates and their fans. And like you said, this is a guy who's in his athletic prime. He's only 24. He's big. He's strong. He's demonstrated that time and again. So hopefully this is just something minor. But, Adam, let's play, worst-case scenario here. If the recovery does not go quite as scheduled, if he's feeling, you know, a little more discomfort or soreness than he expects to, what is perhaps the backup plan if he is not ready to go by opening day at Fenway?
Yeah, I think that's the other reason why it's not a huge concern, because even if he does miss some time, like you said, worst case scenario, you know, he's slow to recover, he's slow to get back into the baseball activities and all that kind of stuff, the Pirates can still turn to last year's first base platoon for a little while. That would be John Jaso and David Freese to man first base. They have a little bit of additional depth on the 40-man roster with Jose Ozuna, the first baseman corner outfielder. And then they have a couple of non-roster invitees who will be in camp with major league experience at first base, Jason Rogers and Joey Turdoslovich. So they have some depth there. Another part where it would get a little bit concerning is if somehow Jung Ho Kang is suspended at the beginning of the season for the off-field issues that we've discussed ad nauseum here. If he is suspended, then you're looking at David Freese at third base to start the year. And if Bell is not active on opening day, it's Jaso at first base, and the bench starts to look a little bit thin. But again, those are complete worst case scenario things to monitor. And even then, the Pirates have experienced major leaguers to cover those positions. So that is probably the one thing to watch, I guess, maybe as spring training ramps up, is the status of Jung Ho Kang, which we still don't know. And, how quickly, I guess, Bell is ready to go.
And, Adam, I know that we set a goal for ourselves week in and week out to get through a podcast without discussing Jung Ho Kang. Once again, we have failed and failed miserably, but, why break a trend, right? What is an expected timetable for when a punishment, if any, could be handed down from the league regarding Gong's difficult offseason so far?
Yeah, we have no idea, which is the big issue with this story, is why it feels like it's kind of hanging over us for so long. We really don't know. I spoke to Neil Huntington the other day. He said they're still working through the process with Major League Baseball, which is sort of driving the whole investigation into Gong's DUI in South Korea, which turned out to be his third since 2009. So the team is going to let Major League Baseball do its thing first, and then if the Pirates need to issue any sort of discipline or Gong needs to be involved in any sort of rehab clinic, which is sort of where there's precedent from past instances like this, then they'll get involved. But I think they're really just waiting for Major League Baseball to kind of issue its stance on this matter.
Adam, I think next week is going to be our week to finally get through a podcast without discussing Mr. Gong. Fingers crossed, but like I said, we failed for this week, so we'll just leave that one there. Adam, shifting gears here on the MLB Pipeline Top 100 prospect list. It was just unveiled a little under a week ago, and on that list, the Pirates land five players, a rather impressive figure. And, you look at some of the names on that list, and they're not unfamiliar to Pirates fans whatsoever. You're talking about the aforementioned Josh Bell. You're talking about Tyler Glasnow. No surprises there. And I think that at this point, fans are pretty familiar with Austin Meadows, the outfield prospect. He could, see the show in 2017. But I want to talk about two other guys on that list that fans may not be terribly familiar with, at least not yet. It's a shortstop Kevin Newman, right-hander Mitch Keller. They're among the top 100 prospects in the game, according to MLBPipeline.com. So, Adam, kind of familiarize us with both Newman and Keller and what kind of ceilings you see for them and when perhaps they could make their debuts with the Pirates, if not this season, then when?
Yeah, we'll start with Keller since he was higher ranked. He took a big jump up the list. I think he moved up 24 spots to number 48 on the top 100. He had a complete breakout year in Class A West Virginia. It was a 2.46 ERA, more than a strikeout per inning. The strikeout-to-walk ratio was over 7, which is absurd. Gave up way fewer than a hit per inning. It's good stuff. It's a lot of poise. I think people are really impressed with not only the projectability that he has, which is a potential number one starter, but also just the floor I think that he has is very very high. When you talk about somebody like Tyler Glasnow, it's a high ceiling, but we've seen what could go wrong if he can't quite figure it out. The floor is a little bit lower. Keller is a really good combination of high ceiling and high floor, I think. He's still a long way away, obviously, and, pitcher injury is always a risk, but, he's expected to start the year in Bradenton, which is high A in the Florida State League. So that could put him about 3 years out from the majors. The interesting part of that timeline is that in 3 years, you'll be looking at Garrett Cole no longer being under club control, the end of Ivan Nova's deal. So there will be room, atop the rotation for somebody like Keller, who is, certainly probably the second highest ceiling pitcher in the Pirates system right now behind Glasnow. And as for Newman, he'll be in big league camp this year, which I was thinking about it the other day. It feels like time has kind of flown by. He was their first round draft pick in 2015, and he's already made it. He could be in AAA this season. He finished last year in AA. He looks like their long-term answer at shortstop. Jordy Mercer's not going anywhere anytime soon. But Newman is just a really good natural hitter. He's not going to hit for a ton of power, but he's a potential high average, high on base guy. Could steal some bases. Not a burning speed kind of guy, but, really solid at shortstop. He's learned a lot by watching tape of Jordy Mercer, actually. That was something we talked about at minicamp a couple weeks ago. He's still got some development to do here in AA and AAA, especially defensively. But I think one of the more encouraging things about him is that last year, they talked basically the day he was drafted about kind of closing up his stance to try to add a little bit more power. He was one of those wide spread legs guy, who just basically slapped the ball everywhere in college at Arizona. So they've narrowed him up. He's hit for a little bit more power. It feels totally comfortable. So, you're looking at a potential up-the-middle defensive player and a top-of-the-lineup hitter, which, that's a really valuable potential player, and you could be looking at it very soon in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, and two guys that Pirates fans should be very excited about, along with the other three that we mentioned. But it appears that Kevin Newman and Mitch Keller are on their way rapidly up the Pirates pipeline in the not-too-distant future. And, Adam, that's a good place to wrap this one up on this second day of February. And next week we're going to be talking Can you believe it? Spring training. That's like you alluded to. It seems like the World Series ended like 2 weeks ago, and here we are getting ready in earnest for the 2017 season. That comes our way next week. But for now, our thanks to you, Adam Berry, for your time. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Pittsburgh Pirates. It is Thursday, February 2nd, and we're talking Brewers baseball today, as always, with our Brewers reporter, Adam McKelvey. Adam, thank you so much for the time. And, Adam, there continues to be speculation about where Chris Carter is going to end up next season. Lots of buzz that the big fella is going to be in Japan. What is the latest on the now former Brewer who led the league, lest we forget, in home runs last season with 41?
Yeah, well, here, I'll start you with a great stat, Matt. And I wrote this, I've written it a couple of times. Chris Carter was the first reigning league home run champion cut loose by his team. In his case, he was non-tendered by the Brewers, who, instead of paying him, they thought up to $11 million in arbitration. $8 to $11 million was the probable number. They decided to sign Eric Thames, of course, for 3 years and 16. They thought that was a better use of the funds. Anyway, Chris Carter becomes the first reigning home run champ cut loose. The last and only, as I know it, home run champ to not spend the next season in the major leagues was Ted Williams when he went off to World War II. So we're talking about a very odd situation for Chris Carter, a guy who went through this whole ordeal last offseason when he was non-tendered by the Astros after a down year. He had no idea he would be in this position this year. I think he thought, and a lot of people thought, he had really done everything the Brewers asked him to do, and he did. I mean, he hit 220 and hit a ton of home runs. That's what you expect out of Chris Carter. It's very unfortunate for him. It must be very frustrating for him that he's in a position to even have to consider opportunities in Japan. But that's where he is. His agent is Dave Stewart, the former D-backs GM who went back to the agency business after being relieved of his duties there in Arizona. He's trying. The Rays have been mentioned. The Rangers have been mentioned. The Rays are probably the best bet if he's to stay here. But it sounds as if those opportunities are not there. A guaranteed job is not there, that Chris Carter is at least willing to take that big bat over to Japan.
Yeah, I mean, you feel for the guy because, you know, like you said, it's a guy that, you know, he did what he was expected to do, and that is, you know, hit for a low average, strike out a lot, and hit a ton of home runs. And that's exactly, you know, check, check, and check. He did all three of those things last year, and you feel for a guy that deserves a spot on a major league team. He may have to go overseas, which is by no means a death sentence. There's plenty of great baseball in Japan, plenty of opportunities, but you're surprised at the same time that a major league club, at least as of yet, has not come calling for a guy that hit 41 home runs in 2016. Adam, in your opinion, does this whole saga say more about Chris Carter himself, or does it perhaps say more about this current age of baseball and the way that we assess value when it comes to certain players?
Definitely the latter. It is a change in Major League Baseball from, for a little bit, their power, and particularly right-handed power, being a pretty valued commodity in the game, it seems, because it became suddenly a rare commodity, to now this wave of GMs, the Ivy League GM, the stat-driven general managers, and even the wave of managers right now. It seems everybody is talking about positional versatility. And I don't know if this is the Ben Zobrist effect or if this goes back earlier than that, but everybody's looking for Ben Zobrist-type players. The Brewers have one in Hernan Perez, who stole 30 bases, had a really solid season at the plate, a switch hitter, can play literally all over the diamond. That's the kind of player Craig Counsell and David Stearns want on this Brewers team, and that's the kind of player other GMs and managers are looking for as well. So for a guy like Chris Carter, for players like Mark Trumbo, to some extent Encarnacion, Bautista, Mark Reynolds, all of these power hitters that, you know, we thought would be in pretty good position going into this winter in terms of finding a job, it's not turned out to be that way. I think it really represents a change in Major League Baseball about the type of player that that teams are valuing.
Yeah, I agree, and it's still stunning when you look at it on the surface without diving too deep into the numbers and the stats and everything like that, that a guy who hit 41 home runs is still unemployed. It's such a dramatic shift in thinking and philosophy and attitude as compared to even, you know, 5-10 years ago. But here's hoping that Chris Carter does find a major league home and continues to terrorize pitchers, at least in terms of the long ball, in 2017, because the guy certainly does deserve a shot somewhere. It's certainly not going to come, though, in Milwaukee. Speaking of a guy that's, Carter, a former Brewer, a guy that could become a future member of the crew, could be Matt Wieters. The free agent catcher is still out there. Somewhat surprisingly, a guy that's got multiple all-star appearances on his resume. He was very good for many years with the Baltimore Orioles. He's by no means old. I believe he's still only in his early 30s, but a report came out that it could be a fit between Wieters and between the crew. What is the latest, if anything, you're hearing about a possible union there?
Well, Wieters is 30. He's a very good player. He certainly would fit the Brewers, who parted with a longtime duo of Jonathan Lucroy and Martin Maldonado in a pair of trades, Lucroy in August to the Rangers and Maldonado to the Angels in December. So, yes, on paper, Wieters is a guy who could fit in Milwaukee. They have three unproven players, including Jet Bandy, a guy they got from the Angels for Martin Maldonado, that they're going to take a look at in spring. Now, this one is a tricky one because everybody I talk to at Brewers on Deck, their fan fest just happened earlier this week as we speak, said no, they haven't shown a lot of interest in him. Besides, it's just a normal kind of checking in due diligence, and it would be a surprise to the officials that I spoke to if they signed him. So it sounded to me like this could be a case of an agent, and in this case, it's Scott Boras, sort of floating a team that makes sense on paper to help along a market that maybe isn't developing the way he wants to for a player. That happens all the time in baseball. But Ken Rosenthal, who is sage and wise and above all else, pointed out something that I did not think of. It makes tremendous sense to me that this is Scott Boras. And Scott Boras has worked with Mark Attanasio, the Brewers owner, in a direct fashion before on players. Kyle Loesch was one who signed a deal late in spring training, a big three-year deal. He has worked with Francisco Rodriguez directly with Mark Attanasio. There are examples of some contact there. Is that happening? Is it not? I don't know. Mark Attanasio did not address that at On Deck, and I'm sure he would not have if I had asked him anyway. That is just something to bear in mind, that this has happened before, that Mark has jumped on what he felt was a good opportunity late in camp and in working with Scott Boras. And Boras isn't the only one. It's happened with Matt Garza and his agents at CAA as well. That's just something for us to kind of keep in the back of our mind as we move forward here. If Wieters remains on that market, it's not completely out of the realm of possibility that the Brewers would take a look. But just to get back to the where I began, the front office people putting the team together, it did not sound to me like they are at this moment pushing very hard on that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it would be a good fit on a few different levels. But again, there is some risk involved and a big reason why, you mentioned the Boras part of the equation, which you cannot ignore. So we'll see where it goes. Maybe he's a guy that does sign late with the team, and then 29 other teams come July are saying, man, that guy was out there. We could have had him, but Milwaukee jumped on it. Stranger things have happened. We'll see how it all shakes out.
And Matt, not to jump on you there, sure. but that's a great thought as well, because those 29 other teams could have him in July. If this works out and this is a short-term deal, how many other players has David Stern split for prospects? And I'm sure this is another case where he could do it. And there's already been talk about it. We talked about it last week. The Brewers signed Neftali Feliz for 1 year. And, are they going to look to flip him in July? I think that's a possibility as well. So that's another sort of notch in the pro Matt Wieters to Milwaukee column, is that he could be trade bait later on.
Yeah, he certainly could. He brought up the other names, Feliz. You could throw a guy like Jabba Chamberlain in there too. Stock up on these guys that have track records on one-year deals, and then considering where you might be at the trade deadline, you can flip them for some prospects and accelerate the rebuild. So we'll see if Matt Wieters becomes the latest guy to kind of join that lineage of guys that could come into the team and pay dividends down the road in terms of some highly touted prospects. And Adam, to begin to wrap up here, the team announcing that in mid-July they're going to celebrate the 35th anniversary, that's hard to believe, of the 1982 American League champions. And yes, I said American League for you younger fans out there. The Brewers, of course, now residing in the senior circuit. But it appears that some big names are going to be at Miller Park that weekend, headlined, of course, by Robin Yount and friends. So how forward are you looking to this, Mr. McKelvey?
Well, look, I've been lucky enough in my gig to be around these guys before. I'm also, you know, at that time, I was a young Brewers fan myself. I've since been neutered of that fandom when you get into this job. But to be around those guys, they sort of slip right back into what you picture the clubhouse being at that time. They do that really quickly and easily. It was a unique group. A lot of players on that team have told me many stories about the characters on that club and just what a family it was. I mean, literally, they'd walk out into the parking lot after game and have a cold one with the fans sitting with their trunks open. It was a very unique relationship between a city and a team that really, the blue collar on both sides of that, and it worked. And really, you know, the best example of that is I don't know of many examples of losing World Series teams getting ticker tape parades down Main Street. That's what the Brewers got in 82 when they came back home. They had thousands of fans waiting for them at Mitchell Airport, and then they did a kind of a parade up Wisconsin Avenue to County Stadium where Robin Yount took his famous lap around the warning track on a motorcycle. It was a very special team. You know, the Brewers keep celebrating it. I don't blame them. I know they would love to celebrate something more recent as well. They almost got there in 2011, and that team will at some point be celebrated as well. But I know they'd love to hang another banner up, and I think the members of that 82 club would welcome that as well, have a little company in the history of this franchise.
Yeah, I'm sure they wouldn't mind, but for now, to be celebrated again on another, you know, round number, I guess, this being 35 years since they won the AL pennant, certainly not a bad thing, and it's going to be a fun weekend at Miller Park in mid-July when the old crew, if you will, is back together once again. A good place to wrap this one up. Adam McKelvey, our Brewers reporter, will do it again at this time next week. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Milwaukee Brewers. Talking Reds baseball today on this Thursday, February 2nd, with Mark Sheldon, our Reds reporter. And Mark, thank you so much for the time as always. And Mark, let's start with a guy that could be reuniting with the Reds, a team he pitched for 8 seasons, I believe. That is none other than the soon-to-be 40-year-old Bronson Arroyo. What is his situation right now? I hear that he could sign with the team on a minor league deal, show up in spring training. It's not a done deal yet, but I think all signs seem to indicate that it will be soon. What's the status of that right now?
Yeah, it sounds like they're just kind of doing the deep dive into the contract and the language and the due diligence and all these things. He's already thrown for the club. He works out here in Cincinnati a lot. He still has his place here. He's got a girlfriend that lives in Cincinnati, so he's been around and working out, and they know him well, and the big thing is really his health. You know, for a guy that never missed a start when he was here with the Reds from 06 to 13, he's missed the entire last 2 seasons with elbow and shoulder injuries, both required surgery. So it's been a different type of situation, but he says he's healthy, that he's moved past it, but the one thing he won't know for sure if he's over the hump until he actually gets into some spring training situations and games, and then he hopes for the best. He wants to compete for that open spot in the rotation against the bevy of youngsters that are vying for the role right now.
And, you know, never say never with a guy like Bronson Arroyo, who's been, like you said, up until a couple of years ago, so dependable and so rubber-armed. If these injury problems are indeed behind him, you know, like I said, never count the guy out. And, Mark, one thing that struck me about your article about this, you know, pending reunion between the Reds and Arroyo was that this is a guy that in Cincinnati is still so incredibly popular. You know, you wrote that he walked into this bar, this restaurant, and was immediately flooded with autograph requests and just well wishes from fans, even though he has not pitched for this team. And going on 4 years now since 2013, that's a long time. Is he just one of those, you know, rare guys that, for whatever reason, is just kind of universally beloved?
Yeah, you know, he's always been a guy, you know, he's always treated people well, not just fans, but the people that work for the team and the clubhouse guys and his teammates. He's just a guy that sets a good example in general. you know, he does have the coolness factor. He's played the guitar and he's done some concerts here when he was a player. He had some very popular local commercials. So he's definitely hit the right notes, and he had his best years here. I mean, you know, he won a World Series with Boston, and he was popular there. He was still kind of a fringe guy in their rotation, but with the Reds, he became kind of a main man. They got him for William O'Pena, which was not much of a good move for Boston, but a great move for the Reds. And he, you know, when the Reds for the longest time didn't have much in the way of pitching, and Arroyo and Aaron Harang kind of brought the pitching back here and started the base of some winning teams. It took a couple years, but he set a good example. He is good with the younger guys, and they're counting on that. That's another reason why he was brought in. They know that he will be a good influence on guys like Robert Stevenson and Cody Reed and Amir Garrett and Sal Romano. And they also know his stuff. They know that he's not going to be bringing it 95 miles an hour. They know he's going to be 85 to 90, but with a lot of deception and be just in a kind of a different dude, and he knows how to pitch. And if he's healthy, he can work deep in games. So all of that kind of put together makes him popular with the fan base and popular on the team.
And I think one thing, too, that has made him popular for so many years is that, in my opinion, he's always had one of the prettiest deliveries of any starting pitcher in baseball. Do you agree with that?
It's definitely a cool delivery. What I like about it is kind of old school in the sense that not only does he have the big leg kick and everything like that, but he comes at you with different arm angles. He's not afraid to throw a curveball for the first pitch and work backwards. He goes sidearm sometimes. It's kind of a little bit like what Raisel Iglesias does now. He's just got kind of a different way of hitting, you know, going after hitters. He's very cerebral. He knows the game really well. Whenever you need to talk about the big picture of baseball, he's the guy to go to because he just gets it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've always likened his delivery, you know, to, say, watching Ken Griffey Jr. or Will Clark swing a baseball bat. That's, you know, poetry in motion. I've always felt that way about the way that Bronson Arroyo delivers that baseball 60 feet, 6 inches from the mound to home plate. Always fun to watch. And to kind of wrap up the discussion on it, Mr. Arroyo, like I said, he turns 40 years old in just a couple of weeks. But despite the age, what has he done, you know, to hopefully, knock on wood, get the health problems behind him? And why is he healthier now than, say, at any point in the last 3 or 4 seasons?
Well, the first one was he tore his elbow and had to have Tommy John surgery. And then there was around the same time he had to have a shoulder fixed. And when he went back to sign with Washington this last year, he almost signed with the Reds, but then went to Washington and he ran into some trouble. He was just not able to throw. He said his elbow just didn't have enough to handle the torque. And in August, he got some stem cell injections, and he says that since then he's been much better, and he's feeling good, and he's been throwing, and so he feels like he's over the hump, at least in theory. But he'll have to obviously put it to test when he's really working the arm and working hard in a spring training situation. He kind of says that the no one can tell him he doesn't have the stuff to make it in the major leagues. He's always had major league stuff, but it's going to be the hitters that let him know whether he can make it or not. If the hitters are beating him up, he knows this won't be a successful venture. But if he can still deceive guys, even throwing in the 80s, then he might be able to help the Reds, and they'll be glad to have him if he can help them. It's a big if. There's no guarantees. It would be a minor league deal. It's a low risk flyer for them. It's a chance for him to pitch for the team where he had his best years. And he said he didn't want to pitch for any other team. This is either the Reds or he's done. So we'll see what he has left.
Yeah, and I know one thing for sure is that everybody is pulling for him. He's a guy that, like we just outlined the last 5 or 6 minutes, for all those reasons, a guy that you just want to root for and a guy that you certainly want to see succeed. Mark, remaining with the pitching front for the Reds, this is kind of old news at this point, but just after last week's podcast, that's when the Reds struck a deal with veteran Scott Feldman. This is kind of an intriguing signing in my eyes because he's one of the rare guys that has extensive experience as both a starter and a reliever. So where exactly within that realm does he fit into the Reds' plans?
Right now it seems like he's going to be the fourth starter. Brian Price kind of envisions him that way right now, but he does have to make the team in the center, or he has to make the rotation at least. He's got a big league contract, but it's more than likely he'll fit in the rotation. And then if things don't go right or one of the younger guys shows that he's ready, he could slide into the bullpen into a relief role. What they like about him is the fact that he gets ground balls. He doesn't walk a lot of guys. They feel like he's got the stuff. He did struggle with Toronto in a relief role after he got traded from the Astros, but his numbers with Houston last year in the first half were pretty good. He's had a nice track record, they feel, even though his ERA, I think, for his career is around four. That will play at Great American Ballpark okay, and they think he's a good fit. I've heard nothing but good things about him as far as clubhouse presence. He's well-liked in Houston, and we'll just see. But right now, it's a veteran guy. They needed a guy after Dan Straley was traded. They took advantage and kind of struck while the iron was hot with him, but they also lost a guy that threw 191 innings last year, and they're hoping to recoup some of that with a pitcher that's capable of going into the seventh inning without much difficulty.
Yeah, and maybe he becomes this year's Dan Straley, you know, like you said, a guy that kind of comes out of nowhere, a low-risk, a high-reward kind of guy. We saw what the Reds did with him to flip him to the Marlins for a couple of highly touted prospects. Maybe that's the path that Feldman follows. We'll see. But for right now, like you said, he'll be a guy to kind of solidify the back end of that Reds rotation. And, Mark, to begin to wrap up here, the top 100 prospects in baseball list was released recently, about a week or so ago, by MLBPipeline.com. The Reds had four players on that list, highlighted by Nick Senzel, who certainly appears to be on the fast track to the big leagues. Thoughts overall on Senzel and the four guys overall that made it for the Reds? I think that the team high for any team in baseball was seven, shared between the Yankees and the Braves. So the Reds had four. Just thoughts in general on the guys that made that list.
Yeah, no real surprises. These are guys, especially Senzel, the number two overall pick last year. He's moving quickly and he's well-liked as far as around the game. They feel like he's coming quick. He won't be really a factor for the Major League club in 2017, but going into a second pro year, they expect him maybe to start either in Double A or High A, but they liked what he did at Class A Dayton after he got kind of comfortable and got used to pitching. Facing pitching again. And the other three guys are familiar faces, and they all could be factors going into this season. Amir Garrett is the second guy. He's going to be in the rotation battle. He's got great left-handed power stuff. Jesse Winker, who's a very familiar name, a former top number one prospect, is now the third prospect. He could be a factor at some point this season. And then, of course, Robert Stevenson, who's going to be also vying for a rotation spot and who was in the big leagues for a while last year, is the number four guy. So, the Reds farm system's come a long way in the last few years. It's been it was pretty woe-begotten for a while, and now after all these trades to bring in guys, they've gotten younger, and they've got some guys that might be able to keep the window of contention open once they're ready to compete again.
Yeah, the farm system is certainly heading in the right direction, and like you said, a welcome change from as recently as a couple of years ago, and that's a good place to wrap this one up on this Thursday. Mark Sheldon, our Reds reporter, our thanks to you, and we will do it again soon for sure. In the meantime, Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Cincinnati Reds. It is Friday, the third day of February, and we're talking Cubs baseball today with Kerry Muscat. As always, Kerry, thank you for the time. And, Kerry, let's start here. The Cubs making a rather intriguing acquisition as of late. They traded for former first-round pick Eddie Butler, who had spent his first three big league seasons with the Rockies. Butler is going to be 26 in March, still very much a young man. He's entering his fourth year now. You know, the numbers on the baseball reference page don't look great, but you also have to factor in that he has pitched at least half his games at Coors Field. That will make any pitcher look bad if the circumstances aren't great. So, Kerry, what do the Cubs see in Butler right now, and what gives them hope that he can, you know, discover that talent that at one time made him a highly touted first-round pick?
I really think just a change of scenery might be best for Butler. He just, as you said, you know, pitching in Colorado isn't very welcome to a lot of pitchers, and I think what the Cubs are hoping is that let pitching coach Chris Fazio work with him, get him out of Colorado, and just sort of start fresh. He's also not he looks more as insurance in terms of the rotation. They're very concerned about making sure they have enough backups, you know, with Lackey and Lester and Arrieta having pitched so much last year. They're just really trying to make sure that they have enough arms. So he's just one of the arms.
And, Kerry, I think I read that he has one minor league option remaining. So how much more attracted did that make him to know that, you know what, he doesn't have to be on the 25-man roster right away? We can put him down in AAA and call upon him when needed.
I hate to say it, but that's really one of the biggest attractions right there, is just having the options. I mean, right now the Cubs are, this will be an interesting spring for someone like Matt Caesar, for example, who does not have options left. you know, and the Cubs are going to have to make a, you know, is he going to be their extra outfielder? Do they take a chance, you know, put him on waivers? That's where the business of baseball gets to be kind of icky.
Yeah, certainly. It does factor
for lack
in.
Of a better word. Yeah,
absolutely. It does factor in whether you have the minor league options or not. So Butler has one left. Caesar does not. And it's going to be a very interesting jigsaw puzzle for Joe Maddon and friends when camp opens up in just a couple of weeks. And, Kerry, with regards to that, the Cubs are going to have quite a few new faces when spring training does open for the team in Arizona. Two dozen non-roster invitees are going to be on hand, and there's a few names in that group that look familiar and stand out. Certainly Munenori Kawasaki is one. Talk about him and talk about some of the other names in that two dozen that kind of intrigue you.
Well, I hate to be kind of a wet blanket here over some of these guys, but there really aren't many openings on the Cubs big league, 25-man roster that'll be breaking camp. What they're really looking at, again, is insurance, you know, giving these guys a chance. Kawasaki, for example, is an infielder who could play multiple positions, so they could call up if somebody were to get hurt. You know, what I enjoy in terms of the non-roster invitees are the kids, the minor leaguers that are invited, you know, somebody like Eloy Jimenez, somebody like John Andreoli, who are really interesting kids to watch and to see sort of the future Cubs. But really the bulk of the roster set for a lot of these players is, can we show them or show someone that we're good for insurance, we're good for backups?
Yes, certainly. And Kerry, the 24 number of, you know, the guys that are going to be invited to camp, is that about average? Is that what you see year to year? Is it big? Is it small? How do you assess that 24 figure?
That's kind of normal. Yeah.
Okay.
And again, I guess what I like is seeing them reward, you know, the kids, like a guy like Ian Happ. Ian Happ is their ranked number one on the MLB.com prospects list for, among Cubs prospects. This is a kid who's just really, or at least I hope so. This is a kid who's really worked hard in terms of making a transit. You know, people were playing him in the outfield. He's a really good middle infielder, second baseman, and he's worked really hard at that. And he had a really good season last year, good off season in the Arizona Fall League. And it'll just be, you know, for him to get exposure to the big league camp, those are the kind of things that I sort of look for more on the non-roster list. You know, Jimenez will be there. That's another, he's number two on the MLB.com list. You know, he's really talented young outfielder, but it's just, this is sort of that introduction to the big leagues that is really just key to them. They'll be able to hang out with some of the other players, you know, see what they do. And it's just such a great learning experience for them.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, you know, for these young guys to be around the veterans, the guys that have experience, and in this case, championship experience, it's invaluable. So that's a great segue to kind of the next topic about, the prospects that are, you know, working their way up the pipeline as MLBpipeline.com. releasing its top 100 list, and five of those 100 in the Cubs system. We've gone through some of the names so far. Eloy Jimenez, we've got Ian Happ, also Albert Almora Jr., who has spent considerable time at the big league level in 2016. So, Kerry, you know, elaborate on those guys a little bit, and maybe in terms of timetables, you know, what are the odds that we could see one or more of them at Wrigley at some point in 2017?
The Cubs have five players in that top 100 list, led by Eloy Jimenez, who came in at number 14. Albert Almora Jr. is on the list also, although I have this argument with the pipeline people every year about some of the kids that they put on there, because Almora is projected as being the Cubs starting center fielder, so
right.
I'm not sure he should be considered really a prospect. He's going to get it's him and John Jay in center as of now. Jamer Candelario comes in at number 96. He came up briefly last year, really good third baseman, really good defensively. And then the kid kind of keep an eye on, but who's making progress, is Dylan Cease, 21 years old. He was a sixth-round pick in 2014 and pitched at Eugene, Class A Eugene, which is a short season, so that's low A ball. Keep an eye on him. I know Jason McLeod, who's the Cubs director of player development and scouting, called Cease one of the more exciting prospects that they have. And so it'll be kind of fun to watch how he progresses. As you can tell, I'm sort of get a kick out of the kids, watching the kids.
Yeah, absolutely. They're fun to watch. You know, these guys that have so much talent, and they're getting exposed, to the big league level, at least in spring training, and we'll see where their journeys take them. And I agree with you on some of the designations and classifications about, you know, is a guy a prospect or not. I found it a little odd that, you know, the number one prospect in baseball is Andrew Benintendi, but he's going to be the starting left fielder for the Red Sox all year, best case scenario. So it's a little, there is some gray area there, but nonetheless, you know, the Cubs getting five players on that top 100, and the pipeline is still very much strong, despite the team graduating so many players from their farm system as part of the core of the 2016 championship team. And Kerry, to wrap this session up, we'd be remiss if we did not mention all the fun on Twitter that Anthony Rizzo is having right now. His latest thing is twerking for ticks, where he wants people to submit dancing videos to his Twitter handle for a chance to win tickets to a Cubs game. He had a very passionate debate about whether a hot dog is a sandwich or not. That's been ongoing for years, but he kind of threw his hat into that ring. Is it safe to say that no active player is having more fun this offseason than number 44?
Well, he is having a good time. I do know that he did. I think he won in terms of the MLB.com awards. Didn't he win social media star of the year?
I believe he did, or he was at least in the running. Yeah.
So I think he's challenging again, trying to defend his title here in 2017. What I like is that the kid that he picked, the contest is over, so people don't need to send him any more videos. But the kid that won was somebody who was leading a cancer patient who was leading some people at a dance marathon at Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. So there's a nice video of that on Anthony Rizzo's timeline. So it's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, but, he's certainly having fun this offseason. There's no question about that. So, and he's going to be getting back to work in just a couple of weeks, along with the rest of his teammates, as the defense for the 2016 title begins, as they try to make it back-to-back in 2017, of course. A good place to wrap this one up today. Kerry Muscat, our thanks to you. We'll do it again soon. In the meantime, it's Matt Wehmeyer signing off for MLB.com Extras, Chicago Cubs.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go, every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.